the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest on this week's program is billionaire investor Kent Fisher. He has a book, Beating the Crowd, using the media basically to make money. Why is that? Well, the media is always running in the wrong direction, and as a result, the herd's always running in the wrong direction. So if you know that, you can make money off of that. You know, by the way, you've heard us talk about the importance of having a financial plan, as if you haven't heard us say that more than once, right? Given the fact that we are at the beginning of the year, why not make putting together a retirement plan a part of your New Year's resolution? However, what we want to talk about right now is a specific part of a retirement plan and concentrate on just your investments on today's discussion. The tax and estate plan are important components of your plan, but your investment plan is your anchor. It is what solidifies your chances of success. So let's face it. I mean, the markets have been, shall we say, jittery since last year?
Just a little bit.
And they haven't shaken it.
Shaken, not stirred.
No amount of Prozac in here has seemed to have solved that. So they've been jittery since last year, and the start of this year was a little more than jittery. It was shaky. So what you don't want to do, and this is really important when you're investing, you have to understand what's happening. You know, in my primary flight instruction, one of the things my flight instructor always used to say, in any situation, do your best to understand what's happening. What everybody else is talking about is unimportant. And then do whatever is really worthwhile to get yourself out of a situation or to handle it. So what you don't want to do, and I'm talking from somebody who has been in the media for 50 years of my career, is find yourself reacting to media hype. I mean, so many investors have done irreparable damage to themselves by getting caught up in the fear and crisis dramatization in the media. And that's why we talk about herds. And there are three rules of herds, by the way. Number one, the herd's always running in the wrong direction. Number two, don't run with the herd. And number three, don't get trampled by the herd when you're busy not running with them. So, Jim, you're going to be discussing this very issue with billionaire investor and author Ken Fisher on his new book, Beating the Crowd, which deals with this type of contrarian thinking and using the media to your own advantage. And that's going to be coming up later on the program. But like last year, markets are volatile and investors are scared. What do you tell investors in volatile markets like today? If you're telling them not to be jittery and not to run with the crowd, what do you tell them?
You just brought up a very important point. John, you and I have been in the media, you more so than I. And let's face it, what does the media do? We're selling something. We're selling news. And how do we get your attention? Well, we're going to keep you glued to the screen. So if there's a crisis, the old saying, if it bleeds, it leads. And boy, if it bleeds, you're going to milk it for all you can get. And you know, I've been in this business 35 years, actually 36, beginning this year. And John, I can't think of a year since I got in this business that we didn't see a crisis. Probably the biggest crisis, at least the first part of my career in the first decade, was the October crash of 1987. I mean, imagine, folks, the Dow dropping 10% on a Friday and then dropping 23% on the following Monday. So that would be like the Dow dropping like 3,800 points in a single day. That would probably get everybody's attention. So that happened in 1987. We bounced back, came through, and had a great bull market that lasted until March of 2000. Then there was the Gulf War, and then there was the recession of 1991. Everybody was predicting a debt crisis. John, you remember this when they were talking about $400 billion deficits? Now, you know, our deficits are $450 billion and it's only 2.5% of GDP. And then in 1994, we had the peso crisis. And imagine this, folks. In 1 year, the Fed, Greenspan took the Fed funds rate from 3% to 6%, doubled it in a single 12-month period of time. Bonds lost 28 to 30%. There was a big crisis in emerging market debt. Fast forward a couple more years, In one day in 1997, we had the Asian crisis with devaluations. The Dow lost 8% in a single session. Fast forward the following year, 1998, it was long-term capital management in Russia. Dow lost another 8 to 10% in a single day. Then we had the events of 9/11. We had the bursting of the tech bubble. We had the financial crisis. And heck, even in this bull market and economic recovery, go back to 2011. You remember what it was like that year? We had Fukushima. We had the Arab Spring. 1.6 million barrels of Libyan oil production was taken offline. Oil prices spiked. We went into the fall with the debt ceiling debate, believing that the U.S. was going to default on its debt. The U.S. got a downgrade on its debt from AAA to AA, where it stands today. And then the pig crisis erupted in Europe. And then, of course, remember last year, what were we talking about right around this time of the year? We were talking about the end of the euro. Greece was going to exit, and that was going to be it. Well, towards the end of the year, it was China, and I'm sure we will have more events. Let's put it this way. China's market has swooned before. We survived it. China suspended trading in their markets in the past, and they'll probably do it again. China stopped allowing shorting before they did it again. And we've survived that too. And Saudi Arabia and events in the Middle East, well, they've been going on for more than centuries. Can you think, John? I can't think of a single year in my lifetime where we weren't talking about some event that was occurring in the Middle East. So that's happened. The world didn't end. Have we seen oil prices collapse? Gosh, I can remember that happening in 1986. I remember it happening again in 1998. I remember when it happened in 1998, the price of oil got down to $10 a barrel. People are predicting that could happen again. If you look at a chart of oil, the next support below 30 is 20, and the next support below 20 is 10. So could it happen again? It could. Will it stay there? No. Will it recover? Yes. So all of these crises, I can guarantee you, listening to this program, whatever crisis we are worried about today, we're going to survive it. And we will be worrying about new ones in the future. There's a tendency in the media to focus on the irrelevant, the now, and not the big picture. And if you listen to the media, that even includes us, and you don't have an investment plan, you're going to be buying when you should be selling, selling when you should be buying, or trading when you should be doing nothing. That is why having an investment plan helps to keep you anchored. It creates less worries and keeps you focused on your long-term objectives.
You know, I guess two bear markets in one decade have really altered the way investors think. Add in the constant media coverage of a crisis or perceived crisis, and that's what makes media go. And you can see why investors get nervous, because they're trying to figure out what's going on, and your source of information is what's critical here. Now, what are the big risks or mistakes that you see investors making today?
The first mistake is what we're talking about here, is no investment plan. So they don't have, let's say, defined objectives or really understand their own personal risk tolerance. Everybody's a little different, and even between husband and wife, risk tolerances can be different. So they become overly pessimistic when we have down markets or overly optimistic when markets are up. And you can see this behavior when you look at mutual fund flows. Last year, investors towards the end of the year pulled money out of active fund managers and then went into index funds right before the market began to plunge. So just as markets began to correct, you know, investors were going back into index funds. So you see this also in a lot of the momentum stocks, like the FANG stocks, where valuations get too extreme. You know, there's nothing wrong with buying those companies, but if you buy them, you don't want to buy them when they're rocketing every single day in price. You want to buy them after a steep sell-off and correction, as we had, let's say, in August or even September. And I would say probably a second mistake that goes along with that is I call it all-in or all-out syndrome. They're either all in the markets or they're all out of the markets, 100% invested or 100% out. I can't tell you the number of investors we have run into over the years who have been on the sidelines from either 2009 or in 2011 when we had crisis after crisis after crisis with the market going nowhere that year. And finally, John, I would say probably the third mistake is they put all their eggs in one basket, like all into bond funds after 2009 or in precious metals, fearing Armageddon in 2011. So to sum it up, there is no direction or focus to their portfolio, so they fall victim to the whims of the media or the markets. I don't know of anyone who got rich listening to the media.
All right, so if we have the markets like they are today, and there's no indication that they're going to get better at any time in the near future, you have to ask, what should investors be doing? And in the light of that question, how do they avoid getting sucked into the short-term, what I call noise and chatter that we're bombarded with on a daily basis and not be influenced by it? In other words, you have to be pulled back further and see the broader picture.
Well, I mean, you should start out with an investment plan. When you often hear John and I talk about retirement plans, one part of a retirement plan is the investment plan that helps achieve the objectives. So you define your capability for risk. What level of risk between husband and wife are you willing to accept? Or if you're by yourself, what level of risk are you willing to accept? What degree of liquidity do you need? And what is your need for income? So you can construct a portfolio that meets your income needs, your tolerance for risk, and more importantly, your long-term objectives. I mean, if you're retired today at age 65, between husband and wife, you're going to spend about 25 years or almost a third of your adult life into retirement. So you need dependable sources of income, and you need to define what those are. And depending on your sources of income, how much assets you have, what kind of investor you are, moderate risk, low risk, high risk, that's going to involve some form of different asset classes. It could be fixed income, such as bonds or annuities. It's going to be stocks for growth and income, or it could be real estate, maybe some cash, and maybe a small amount of bullion. But if you have a laddered bond portfolio, you don't need to do much. You sit back, collect your checks. If you are a dividend stock investor, well, collect your dividends and look forward to your dividend increases. And your cash and your gold, well, it's there for liquidity. It's insurance, emergency purposes, and sometimes, in markets like this, opportunities.
Well, Jim, I know your firm tends towards active management to raise or lower cash depending on what the indicators are telling you is going on in the economy or in the financial system or the markets. But at the same time, like many of our technicians, I don't believe you go to 100% cash at any given point.
I mean, we may go up to 40% of cash levels depending on what indicators are telling us, John, but we would never go 100% in cash. That would be, gosh, if we had to go to 100% in cash, that would be Armageddon. And I guess under Armageddon, cash would be the worst place to be because you would be talking about a collapse of the financial or banking system or a major currency devaluation where you could lose 50% of your purchasing power or your money overnight. And I remember this because this happened early on in my career. And folks, this was the good old days, but in the early 80s, that was back when treasuries were paying 15%. You got 14% on government Ginnie Mae's. The banks were paying you 12 and 13%. As high as that seemed, believe it or not, this was a story that hit us locally here. CDs in Mexico were paying 18%. I mean, why settle for 12 at the bank and a toaster and a Vegematic when you can get 18% in Mexico? So a lot of people were crossing the border and putting their money in Mexican banks. New president comes into office and overnight, wham, he devalued the peso by 50%, which means if you put your money in pesos, let's say you put $100,000 in a jumbo CD, when you turned it back into American dollars, it was only worth $50,000. So in an Armageddon scenario, I wouldn't be in cash because in an Armageddon scenario, you're talking about a banking crisis, a financial crisis, or even worse, a devaluation. The problem we have today is there is just more money that is institutional that is operating in the markets, either large institutions or mutual funds and ETFs where a lot of investors have parked their money. So when you have down markets or corrections phases like we've saw, let's say, last August and September, or like we're seeing since the beginning of the year, You have investors trying to decide whether to stick it out or just bail out now and take all the chips off the table. The problem is, investors are shooting first and asking questions later. And that's an approach that is very hazardous to investments, because there are consequences of that. Because what happens is this type of panic selling is forcing well-meaning mutual fund managers to do their bidding and sell out of perfectly good stocks to meet their redemption demands of those frightened investors, which means, you know, a lot of high quality companies are being sold. And this means if they sell, they're probably selling them at distressed prices. So if you do have cash, whether it's stocks like in the bottom in August or September, or even some of these bonds that are being liquidated by these bond mutual funds, if you have cash, this is a great time to step in if you're looking for things on your shopping list and pick them up at a better price.
But it also means that if they are selling, they're probably in cash. And if you're relying on your investments as a continual source of income, say in a time of retirement, that would seem to present a problem, because obviously in cash, you're not going to get much.
Well, it creates two major problems. If you're selling a dividend paying stock or a dividend paying mutual fund, now you're no longer getting the dividend. So you have to ask, what's going to replace that dividend? What are you going to do with the money? How are you going to get the income to replace it, especially if you're living off your investments? And if you're cash, you're probably going to get next to nothing. You're probably in a money market fund. The second problem you have on your investments, and especially if they're held outside of a pension fund, if you're in an IRA, you don't have this problem, or a pension plan, the second problem you have is taxes. And that can be as little as 15 to 25% to over 50%, depending on whether it's short or long-term capital gain, or what tax bracket and state that you live in. So you have to ask yourself, how are you going to replace the lost income you're no longer getting from the dividend stock you sold, or the dividend mutual fund, or the lost principal as a result of paying your capital gains taxes? Not only capital gain taxes to the feds, but also depending on the state you live in, you may also own your own state taxes as well. And if they're short-term gains, those taxes can be quite hefty, as anywhere from 35 to over 50%, depending on your tax bracket.
You know, is there any way to evaluate what you should be doing? Because, you know, you're drawing in all these variables, because the question is, would you advise people not to sell then and just hold on? And how do you know you're doing the right thing?
Well, I mean, there are times you do want to trim gains and take some profits. I mean, things got pretty crazy at the end of the 90s and at the end of the middle of last decade before the crisis. But you always maintain your core portfolio investments. And especially if you're retired and living on investments, you just can't go all or nothing. Because if you do raise some cash, take some money off the table, you're going to want to redeploy that cash, especially and take advantage of market corrections. I mean, right now, bond funds lost money last year for investors. And so what are investors doing? They're pulling money out of bond funds. And what are the bond fund managers doing? They're being forced to sell bonds at distressed prices, which means it creates an opportunity. I mean, we're using this time right now. We've been picking up bonds for our laddered portfolio, especially in the 2 to 4 year range, picking up yields anywhere from 5 to 10%. So if you're a dividend investor, you could also use these times to pick up more shares of your favorite dividend stock with a higher dividend yield because the price is down. I mean, if a stock you owned was paying you 3.5% dividend, and let's say, I don't know, it's down 10%, you know, the dividend yield is probably 4%. So dividends may be paying 4 to 4.5%. So dividends now, after a market downturn, I mean, I love market downturns. That's when I really enjoy buying the most, because I like to buy things that generate cash like dividends. And if I have favorite stocks, well, I know what's going to happen in a downturn. I'm going to be able to get those stocks at a much, much better price. And that's what you do when you have an investment plan. You say, all right, I've allocated 40% of my portfolio to stocks. Right now, that I've taken that percentage down because, you know, I've liquidated, taken some chips off the table, or maybe you had some bonds that were in your laddered portfolio and they came due. And now you have an opportunity. You can pick up more bonds now and get a higher yield. You can pick up stocks now and get a higher yield. So you use market corrections or bear markets to, let's say, increase your income and the yield on your portfolio. It's a different way of looking at markets. Rather than fearful, You know, it's no different. I mean, how many people would love to go to, I don't know, their favorite department store when they mark things down 20-30%? We all love bargains.
So I guess you're not buying into the arguments that the sky is falling. I mean, we keep hearing that all over the place. And this is despite with the problems we had at China right at the beginning of the year and earlier in last year, the stock market's being down right now. And the Fed seems intent on raising interest rates again, albeit it may just be a little, but nevertheless, they intend to do it. But you're not saying that as a imminent crisis type situation.
Well, I mean, you know, the saying that we have here, if they continue to raise, they're going to create the very crisis that they're trying to put some bullets in the chamber. We talked extensively about that on the weekend show. But when I take a look at where we are today, and all these people are calling for Armageddon, the end of the world. And we talked about this on the first show we did of the year, but, you know, contrast 2008, oil at $150 a barrel. We didn't have enough of it today as a result of fracking, shale oil, horizontal drilling. Oil is at $30 a barrel. Instead of offshoring, which was much the topic in the political debates of 2008, we're reshoring. U.S. corporations, all the major ones, are bringing back and building factories here. Instead of a housing glut, we got a housing shortage. Instead of excessive bank leverage of 40-1, banks are more down to their normal rate of up to 10-12-1. Corporate balance sheets were thin back in 2008. Today, they're sitting on $2.3 trillion in cash. Household debt burdens have come down. The savings rate is higher. Income to debt ratios are better. Income to asset ratios are better, reflecting what's happened to real estate and what we've seen in the stock market. And the budget deficit, 400-something billion, is around 2.5% of GDP. It's no longer 10.5%. So, John, there are a lot more things that are right today than we're going wrong. We're nowhere near where we were in 2008. So I'm not saying things are going to get better or less volatile in the short run, because they could be. There's too many cross currents right now with the big question that, you know, a lot of people are scratching their head right now. What the heck is the Fed doing talking about raising interest rates? We don't have high inflation. We don't have overheated economy, and we have problems overseas that the Fed in many ways is creating by tightening here. They're withdrawing liquidity, driving up the dollar, which is hurting corporate profits. You do that enough, corporations are going to start laying off people. So key indicator we're watching is what's going to happen to these job numbers going forward. But basically, these problems sort themselves out. If you've raised cash, don't be afraid of markets. Have a plan and use that plan to take advantage of the markets when they present themselves. Corrections or bear markets should never be feared, but looked upon as a great investment opportunity. I mean, think back, folks. Back in 2009, we thought the end of the world was coming. But look what you could have picked up real estate for. In 2009, 10, and 11, and 12, there were great bargains in real estate. There were great bargains in the stock market. And that's what you want to use your cash for. So corrections in bear markets, you know, you want to take some precaution ahead of them. There's nothing wrong with raising cash, but this whole idea the world's going to end, I got to get 100% in cash, folks. If it's an Armageddon scenario, cash is the last place you're going to want to be in.
So if we sum this all up for today, when we talk about investments, as we've always said, you want to have a retirement plan. And part of that plan includes your investment plan. That plan is the strategy to navigate the markets and to help you achieve your investment goals. Now, your investment plan should be diversified, so you don't have all your eggs in one basket and expose yourself to one single risk there. You want to avoid especially having to panic or to react to the whims of the media or respond to every known or unknown or imagined crisis. This is a subject you're going to talk about with your guest coming up next, billionaire investor Ken Fisher and his new book on beating the crowd. But first of all, before we get to that, we have this week's case study. We take real life case studies, as in all of the studies that we do here, they are real life events, but we change the names of the people who are involved to protect their privacy. So our pair this week are...
Our pair this week are Bill and Jan Clark. Bill, age 69, Jan, age 62. Some brief background information before we get to some of the real important issues here. Bill's Social Security was roughly about $2,450 a month. That's $29,400 a year, roughly about $29,000 of income. Jan, age 62, recommended wait to age 66, at which time her Social Security, which would be really half of Bill's, would be $1,320. She could get it right now at age 62. She would only get 75% of it. So it'd be less. At age 66, that Social Security was going to be roughly about $16,000 a year, which would bring in about $45,000 from Social Security. They had a home in Rancho Bernardo. They downsized from their much larger house, paid cash for it. It was valued roughly about $700,000, no mortgage on that home. Bill's IRA was about $800,000 in cash, basically CDs at around 1%. Their trust account was basically in cash as well. We'll get to why all of this cash. That was $400,000. That was basically in CDs as well. Jan's IRA was worth about $60,000. And they had about $325,000 in bullion and about 6,000 shares of the company's stock. It was a high-tech stock here based in San Diego that Bill worked for as an executive. He had 6,000 shares. That was roughly about $300,000. So a total portfolio worth about $1.9 million. Here's the problem. You know, this is really tells you a lot about the times. I can remember when $1 million, I can remember getting 10% on $1 million or 8%. You sure can't get that today, and certainly not at the bank. The problem was when Bill retired at age 62, his trust assets at that time were worth about $1.1 million, roughly about $500,000 coming from what was left over after selling their big house and downsizing to a smaller house. His IRA rollover from the company was worth roughly about $1.3 million. He had 6,000 shares of his company's stock. They had basically downsized and went to a smaller home. So the retirement plan was basically wait to age 65, collect Social Security, live off the investments. The yield on investments were much higher than where they were now. And the plan was basically collect Social Security, which would bring in close to $26,000, $27,000. It's gone up since he started collecting Social Security. And the plan looked pretty good. I mean, most people would say, gosh, if you had close to $3 million in investment assets and plus Social Security and a free and paid for home, you know, what's there to worry about? The problem was the 401k plan was rolled over into an IRA. At the time he retired, that was worth roughly about $1.3 million. It was worth that until the financial crisis happened in 2007 to 2009. That $1.3 million dropped down to almost $900,000. Bill panicked, sold out, went into cash, and was pretty much in cash until about 2011. And now remember, folks, what was happening in 2011? All the bad things that we were worried about Fukushima, how that changed the energy environment and nuclear power. We were worried about oil and energy prices with Libya and the Arab Spring. Oil prices were spiking over $100 a barrel in the fall. We had the worries that the U.S. would default on its debt payments. Standard & Poor's downgraded U.S. debt from AAA down to AA. As soon as that crisis was over, Europe, the pig crisis began erupting. Its bond yields, there was talk of the euro breaking up, bond defaults, all of that. Gold prices were soaring, silver prices were soaring, and Bill put about $500,000 into bullion. That bullion, when we met him, was worth roughly about $325,000, lost about 35% on it. And so one of the problems that we tried to explain to him, I go, look, your income, you spend between $75,000 and $80,000 a year. That budget, by the way, used to be much higher. They used to spend and do a lot more traveling than they did, but they had to pare it back because they were basically, in many ways, eating into their principal because the income they were getting in cash. And it was only in the last year, as interest rates start to rise a little bit, that they put some of the cash mainly in money market funds because they were afraid to make another mistake as they made in bullion. It was only in the last part of last year that they even went to CDs and got close to 1%. The problem was that wasn't producing enough income, so they cut back on their travel and they were gradually chipping off some of their principal by spending some of it to make up the difference. And so this was what we suggested. They go, look, you've got to have something in your portfolio that's predictable. I understand that you don't want to have everything in the stock market like you did back in 2006 when you retired and rolled over your 401k program. So what we did is we said, look, you got way too much money in gold. So we pared his gold back down. We pared his gold by $200,000. We left $100,000 in cash because they wanted it for emergency. And I said, there's nothing wrong with that. And, you know, eventually, if we get a major correction, you're going to want to deploy some of that. So we had about $860,000 in the IRAs. So we had about $1.4 million. We put together a bond portfolio, a ladder bond portfolio, about $800,000 in bonds. That was about 4%. That was $32,000 a year. Dividend paying stocks, roughly a little over $500,000. That was 3%. That was roughly almost $17,000. In his company stock, 6,000 shares, that had a 4% dividend. That stock was down. And this was one of the things that I was talking to Bill, and I said, look, Bill, you work for a great company. They're a technology leader. I mean, you remember what happened to your stock in 2000 and 2002? You were working at the company. You stuck with it. Look where it is today, even though it's down recently in the last 6 months. I go, it's the same thing when you own good quality stocks. I mean, if you can hold on to your company stock, it's the same thing with high quality dividend stocks. So we were able to convince them that you've got to have something like this in your portfolio. So we put a little over $500,000 in dividend paying stocks in his own stock. So his investment income was $60,000. That was $29,000 coming from his Social Security. So his income now was back up over $89,000. He didn't have to dip into principal to live on, and he could actually begin to increase his travel again, because also in 4 more years, Jan's Social Security would be kicking in, and that was going to be another $16,000 a year, which would bring his income up to almost $104,000 a year, which is more than enough to live on. But John, it was actually putting together an investment plan, showing him this is what this investment's going to do, and then also getting him to reason through some of the irrational fears about, look, you've held on to this company stock. You worked for them most of your life. You held on during the tech bubble. You held on during the financial bubble, and your stock is much higher today than where it was back then. So, you know, it's the same thing when you buy good, high-quality dividend stocks. And so that was how we solved this particular problem, by creating an investment plan that would meet their income stability, their tolerance for risk, but at the same time would give them that inflation hedge.
But what you notice here also, Jim, pursuant to what we were discussing earlier on, is that a lot of his earlier decisions were based on panic decisions and running with the herd again, seeing things and making the wrong investments. And until the plan was put in place, you couldn't stabilize that.
No, because like in 2009, it was like it was Armageddon, at least it looked like that in the fall of 2008, before the government stimulus and all the backstop programs kicked in, and he went to cash. And then in 2011, it was Armageddon again. This time he was going into gold because, you know, the downgrading, the U.S. was going to default on its debt. We had oil prices rising to over $100 a barrel. I mean, it looked like Armageddon all over again. And what he was doing was letting that fear drive him into, this time on the buy side, when he was actually buying at the peak of the market in the gold market. And unfortunately, he held on to it for way too long, fearing the worst.
But, you know, it was a successful recovery. So I guess in the long run, you could say it was very successful. Coming up next, billionaire investor Ken Fisher beating the crowd. He talks about using the media to make money by not running with the herd. It's going to be an interesting interview as Lifetime Income continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Mainstream investors are wrong more often than right. Most folks intuitively know this, and statistics and studies back it up. How can you buck the trend and be right more often than wrong? Joining me on the program is author Ken Fisher. His new book is called Beat the Crowd, How You Can Outvest the Herd by Thinking Differently. Ken, in your book, you talk about contrary thinking has been a theme that has run throughout many of your books that you have written, but you never overtly addressed it. So in this book, you wanted to address the issue. In your opinion, it's more about independent thinking. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. When I was young a long time ago in a world far, far away, contrarianism was generally thought of then as try to figure out what the crowd's thinking and think that the reverse will happen. In theory, what should happen is what consensus agrees on should be priced into markets and therefore should not occur. But beyond that, theoretically, anything could happen. And the traditional notion of contrarianism seems to me in this day and age to be flat wrong, because it's easier and easier and easier to see the consensus through the internet, to see what people tend to agree on, to be able to build up consensus metrics. And therefore, today there's always the herd, and then there's what I call the anti-herd herd, or the folks that are set up to be the reverse of the herd. So there's really two herds. And what that really tells you, in my view, is that you figure out what people think and you figure out the people that are opposed to that and what they think, and then some other thing happens. So figuring those first two out allows you to improve the odds as you contemplate other possibilities. Another way to say that is simply that if everybody thinks the market will be up in a given year, 40 years ago, a contrarian would have said, so I think it'll be down. Today, when everybody says it'll be up, you can kind of metric how much they think it'll be up, and that's pretty easy to do today. And then it'll either be up a lot more, or it'll be up a lot less, or it will be negative. And all of those are possible, because what it probably won't be is the exact reverse of what people thought.
You know, there's a real battle today. If you really want to be an independent thinker, as you talk about in your book, you have to battle the financial blogosphere. You got websites and TV. One of the problems I think investors have today, Ken, and I'm even talking about professionals here, you go back 30, 40 years ago, you had three network television networks that you could watch, and you had the one dominant newspaper in your town. That's not the world we live in today. We've got tweets, we've got blogospheres, websites, cable TV, everything. You believe you need to train your mind and brain to battle the media, the crowd, your friends, your neighbors, and learn to think differently. So, I mean, you have multiple sources that are trying to feed input to you that you've got to ward off and step back from.
Let me speak to that differently. In that earlier world, the world that people lived in nearly forever, you had then magazines that you received in the mail, which were a few weeks old when you got them, that had been planned a few weeks before that. And you might have had a little bit of radio, but not the talk radio we have today nonstop. Today, I mean, literally, if you were interested last night, you could see the State of the Union address in writing before he delivered it, which is very different from once upon a time where people would have gathered around the television to listen to the president deliver the State of the Union. And today we are not only bombarded by so much, but we're also bombarded by sources that we do not know if they are credible or not. And in fact, the most credible of them have become less credible because they're competing in this boiling cauldron of media to try to get things to you right here, right now, so fast that they don't actually have time with good intent to be very careful or very accurate. And the dilemma with all of that is that it confuses us, it bewilders us, sorting through it is problematic, and it makes us less confident, less slow moving, more myopic, more prone to think that little market movements are terribly important, that little things we read about bombarding us online that we got at 10:30 last night are terribly important and that we should pay attention to. It's as if you don't even have time to sleep anymore.
Yeah, I mean, you also talk about, too, there's a lot of decisions, maxims, things such as confirmation bias that the media spends a lot of time on. I mean, there's quotes out there, sell them, go away, come back after Labor Day. I mean, there's, you know, the January effect, all these kind of things that you also have to deal with that are sort of like these rules that are out there that sort of hang around and people often refer to them?
Well, A, that's true. B, I've been guilty of using many such things in my life myself. My debunkery book a few years ago specifically took to task most of those that you mentioned and a lot more. But if you just take a look at the year we're in right now, there is so much that I think is inexplicable to so many people, like how can a guy like Don Trump, that's never run for anything, ever be number one on the Republican side? How can Hillary Clinton be seen as the front runner on the Democratic side when she's running behind Bernie Sanders in the early states? What will happen? How do we understand this? How do we explain it? You'll see the rule of thumb that people will say, which is partly true and partly false. For example, relative to this year's presidential election, that the Electoral College is biased in favor of the Democrats. But if you look at state houses in the country, and if the state houses that were all red today voted Republican for president, you couldn't possibly elect a Democrat president of the United States in the Electoral College because it swings the other way around. All of the rules of thumb have a counterpoint. And the key is to kind of see that the more this stuff is perceived, the more you need to think through the counter argument. And let me just take that one that I mentioned. I think very few people see in a world where the media will tell you endlessly things like the rise of the independent voter that is neither Republican nor Democrat, which is true. The voter today calls himself or herself independent. They do not so much call themselves Republicans or Democrats, though they used to. But if I call myself a blind monkey that's an illegal alien from outer space, that doesn't make me that. It just is what I call myself. And in fact, if you actually look at the way the country votes, it votes very differently than that. And much of what we get today, going back to the original question that you asked, we have difficulty with because America has a couple of different countries in it at the same time, and only one of them is very urban, and the very urban one is the one that the media reflects, and the non-urban one the media doesn't really understand and reflect much at all, and that's half of American life today.
Let's talk about an example of this, and especially now with the movie The Big Short out there. The financial crisis, 2008, what people didn't focus on, and you write about this in your first chapter, is an little statement or an accounting rule, FAS 157, the fair value measurement, how that impacted the financial crisis. Could we talk about that for a minute?
Sure. So there was FAS 157 and then its non-US counterpart, IASB 157, both of which did the exact same thing, which is to force banks to do mark-to-market accounting for the illiquid securities that were collateralized mortgage obligations, whether residential or commercial. And in that process, there's no actual way to do that correctly because there's no market to mark them to. So whatever somebody else wrote them down to, because of the interplay of this law or any other law with Sarbanes-Oxley, the CEOs and CFOs of the publicly traded companies, in this case, primarily the big banks and investment banks, would be criminally and civilly liable if they were found to have material earnings deficiencies from not moving fast enough. They just got into a musical chairs game of writing down the assets, writing down the assets, writing down the assets, which took down their statutory book value, which took down their ability to make loans. And the total aggregate of that globally was $2 trillion plus. And that $2 trillion is the piece of the puzzle that nobody can understand in real time. It's the part that's the tipping point. And still today, people don't understand that, in that if you look at a $70+ trillion global GDP that's normally growing without inflation at a couple of percent a year, you need new big bad things of at least a couple of trillion bucks to turn an expanding economy into a recession. The fact of the matter is a few $100 billion here and a few $100 billion there sounds like, as Everett Dirksen once upon a time would have said, real money, but it's not enough to get you there. You need literally trillions of dollars of new big bad in today's global economy. And that was the elephant. That was the trillions of dollars of new big bad that nobody saw coming at the marketplace, which just imploded the bank's abilities to make loans. And yet today we perceive the banks as solely bad guys. And you could hear that in the president's State of the Union address last night. And in fact, in reality, this accounting rule, which was little noted at the time, happened just before the beginning of the bear market and was obliterated by the SEC as a law just a couple of weeks after the end of the bear market. Otherwise, we could have still kept writing all that stuff down all the way to zero. It's a bottomless pit of regulatory demise.
Isn't that what part of the recovery, too? Wasn't it in March or something when they got rid of that in 2009?
Yes, it was just 2 weeks after the March 9th bottom in 2009 that they got rid of that. It went into place just before the market peaked in 2007, and it was obliterated by SEC fiat in later March of 2009, just after the bear market bottomed. Again, quite simply, this set of rules, which sounded good to them when they put it in place, was a bottomless pit. And one of the sad parts about regulatory, and it was done with good intent. There was never any bad intent in these kinds of things. But, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And that good intent, quite simply, was a bottomless pit that, because it linked a non-market event to any other write-down you could see, if somebody else wrote something down, your obligation was to write yours down lower. Then somebody else would see yours and they'd have to write theirs down lower. And if they didn't do that, and there was a material loss on your books at the end of the day, you could and might be found criminally and civilly liable. It's a tremendous irony in today's world that there's so many people that want to go back and say, why weren't bankers and investment bankers put in jail? Well, the reason a lot of bankers and investment bankers weren't put in jail is because they were neither accused nor convicted of a felony. And that's kind of central to the process. And they're actually pretty good at making sure they don't do that. And they're pretty thoughtful about those things to make sure that doesn't happen, because not very many people really want to go to jail, particularly people in those kind of positions, and they're surrounded by lawyers. And that process literally leads us in a circumstance like that to hell. It's a point that we don't often see, and nobody saw at the time. I didn't see it as it was happening. I didn't see it until October of 2008, and by then it's almost over. It's a funny part of our world, because regulations which are not voted on by Congress, or in some other country a similar way by a legislature, signed by a president or whatever, are ones that we don't really see vetted in front of us, therefore aren't discounted into pricing in the marketplace, and can have huge negative repercussions. That surprised the heck out of me at the time, and in my mind is relatively unprecedented. The other parallel point that I talk about in that book, which I think is unprecedented in history, is that the banks and investment banks that stepped in to do roles that they always did at the request of regulators, which was to help bail out the troubled ones, those that raised their hands to volunteer and be the good guys are the ones that then came and were whacked later by the government. And the penalties of the volunteers versus the penalties for the non-volunteers after the fact is a staggering phenomena, which said to all of the big banks and investment banks that are still standing, the next time there's a debacle, don't raise your hand and volunteer to help. Stand out of the way, let other people do it. Because if you volunteer to help, they're going to whack you. And so next time, we're not going to get them willing to step forward and do things like the takeover of Countrywide, or J.P. Morgan taking over Bear Stearns, or because the more you volunteered to help, the more they whack you.
I want to come back to that in your chapter on politics. I want to talk about professional groupthink, and especially forecasters. Here we are. It's the beginning of the year. Forecasts are out from Wall Street. The general consensus is it's going to be a year of great volatility. The market isn't going to do much. Expect low gains on stocks and a lot of volatility. That seems to be the consensus. Let's talk about professional groupthink, because that's exactly what we experienced last year. The market did little of anything. In fact, lost little ground. One market was up like the NASDAQ, but we had a lot of volatility in the markets. And here we are, the beginning of the year, the same forecast and volatility in the markets. So what does one think when you look at that standing back? How do you assess that?
Well, in books of mine going back some years, I've advocated that you, at the end of the year, collect professional forecasters' forecasts for the year ahead and array them in kind of a bell curve-like pattern, and that the middle of that bell curve pretty much never, ever happens, because these people are people who are avid collectors of information. They interact with the world, or are the world, or both, that place the bet. And therefore, they are that which has been discounted into pricing in the time frame that markets discount, which is out about 12 months, and maybe a little more, maybe a little less. So that forecast range of lukewarm, now you said, and I'm being cute here, but you said, you know, great volatility. I think all volatility is great. I just think it's marvelous. You meant a lot of volatility. And again, volatility comes and goes, but you don't get an up a lot market without volatility, and you don't get a down a lot market without volatility. People only think of the down part as volatile, whereas the up part is also volatile. But with those forecasts that you see of median expected return of 7.5% for this year, looking at global forecasts for U.S. and global markets, I'd say categorically that the market is either up a lot or it's a flattish to negative market. And you have to take your choices as to what you think it is. But because I think volatility is normal, not exceptional, and stocks just move a lot and the potential for a 10% quarter is always up or down is always there, you could easily still see after the down start to the year, a 30% year. And to that point, I make the point that as we speak, there's been a lot of news about how bad last week was in the stock market. But in fact, last week was only a little bit worse than the first week in 1998, which ended the year up 28%. And that's just the nature of equities being volatile. They bounce around a lot. People tend to want to read too much today into myopic short-term movement.
I want to move on, and you talk about the flawed financial eyesight of the media. Sometimes what seems important or pressing that the markets are focusing on, and this goes to something that we see now with the advent of financial cable stations where you have 24-hour financial news. But the media puts a lot of emphasis on an individual economic report. I think things, as you point out in your book, like the leading economic indicators, which is more encompassing, tells a more complete story than, let's say, a single employment report.
Well, that's true. That's categorically true, but it's got a weakness to it, which is that helps you figure out what the economy is going to do. It doesn't so much help you figure out what the stock market's going to do, because the stock market itself, of course, is one of the best leading indicators in developed nations, which is where it matters, are in every country's leading economic index. The fact of the matter is that, as the book points out at some length in two chapters devoted to this, markets don't really care about the short term. And they don't really care about the very long term. Markets care about the next approximate 3 to 30 months. And anything much further out than that, simply they disbelieve, whether it's going to be true or not. They'll worry about it when it gets closer. If it's shorter term than that, people will chatter about it and they'll claim that volatility is associated with it, but it's just volatility, it's not the direction of the market. Markets discount the approximate next 3 to 30 month activities. And so today we get all of this chatter, and the media is usually focused on either very short-term phenomena, what's right here in front of our face that has little to no market import, or things that are way far out into the future, like the bankruptcy of Social Security or climate change or the kids are no good or whatever. So you can get these tremendous interests, partially because they attract eyeballs and they're sensationalistic and people like to read about them, and they might actually be very important in non-market ways. And I'm not suggesting that they're not, and I'm not suggesting that any of those long-term or short-term topics aren't of tremendous import to your listeners. But as they relate to figuring out where the market's going, they don't help you at all, and the media just is noise that troubles you and reflects all of that being priced.
I want to talk about, and you have a chapter on this, the next 30 months. Let's talk about that, because there's calls for a crash. There's calls for a recession. As you mentioned, this is a political election year. So the issues on Social Security, Medicare, I can't turn on a cable station with some guy telling me to buy gold because of the national debt, or, you know, I should be fearful. It's raining. It's flooding in California, global warming.
Yes, all of that's true. And the fact is that global warming and the national debt and all those are things that are beyond the 3 to 30 months. And if you just think of the national debt one, for example, without getting into the argument, you couldn't find a year in the last 25 years where that argument wasn't made endlessly. And some of your other points are equally valid, but equally permanent, in that you've always got calls for crashes and you've always got calls for doom and gloom. And you've always got calls for boom. And the fact of the matter is that the more gloom calls you've got, the less likely it is you actually get gloom, because that's priced into the market. But the reality of all of that is that few folks are focused on the time period that markets care about, which is the next 3 to 30 months. And let me just give you an example of that. At the point that we're at right now, this year, more than any presidential election that I can recall, we've got quite a lot of uncertainty as we move close to New Hampshire and Iowa, and then on to what really matters, which are the two Super Tuesdays on March 1st and March 15th, where at the conclusion of them on the Republican side, 60% of the delegates will have been decided, whereas only 5% of the delegates will have been decided after New Hampshire and Iowa. The point that I'm making is we're still too early for the market to discount the 3 to 30 month phenomena, which is the election, and even who the candidates will be, which begins to get clearer as we move into the year further down the road. And so we've got a lot of uncertainty. Markets don't like uncertainty. Markets like certainty. We get a lot more certainty as the year progresses. So one of the features about election years that's not widely appreciated, and I'm not going to hang my hat on this and lay my life down on it, but typically as you move through the election year, you get more certainty. And as you get more certainty, markets tend to do better. Are there exceptions to that? Of course, 2008 being a perfect example of an exception. But for the most part, unless there's something extraordinary going on that overrides the normalcy of the election cycle, as you move through the election cycle, uncertainty falls away. As uncertainty falls away, markets do better. And in fact, 80% of the time in history, in an election year, the U.S. market does better than the non-U.S. market in the period starting June 1st. Why? Because the market discounts the next 3 to 30 months.
I want to talk about the elephant in the room. Like one of the elephants going back to the financial crisis was that FASB rule that was put into effect that forced all these write-downs that we saw with banks. And of course, it fed on it itself. It's really difficult sometimes when we're bombarded with all kinds of information, as you talk about in the book, whether it's the blogosphere, whether it's cable TV, it's tweets, you name it. How does one stand back and say, all right, here's what everybody's thinking. What should I be looking for that nobody's looking at?
When I answer that question, I've got to say that every general rule I would give you is obviously going to have some exceptions to it. But there's almost no exceptions to the point that we don't go into terrible times when the spread between short-term and long-term interest rates is relatively deep. If you take, for example, in throughout 2008, short-term rates and long-term rates were effectively identical, otherwise known as a flat yield curve. Getting a flat yield curve doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have bad times, but you pretty much never have bad times when the spread between short and long rates is more than about 1%, like it is now and like it is most of the time. The fact is, it's a simple elephant. It's a positive elephant now, but people don't think about that. All those folks that are arguing gloom and doom today are arguing gloom and doom, which is a statement in a sense that it's different this time, which is, of course, a common statement. And as John Templeton famously said, the four most dangerous words in the English language are it's different this time. But the reality is that they're arguing that when the yield curve is nicely, positively sloped upward, meaning that short rates are well below long rates, and you expect doom and gloom, you're asking for something that's pretty much never happened before. And then you look at that and you say, well, maybe that could happen, but you need to find big bad things that aren't priced into the market that everyone isn't talking about. And when you look around, you say to yourself, are people just talking about the things that people have been talking about for a long time? And if they are, isn't that priced? And therefore, how does that have market power? Because if everybody's been talking about it, it is priced and it doesn't have future market power. Another one that's one of my rules that I've had for a long time, again, it's not perfect, but it's pretty good, is that when you get into what you consider to be the second half of a bull market and an economic expansion, and particularly the longer it is, the more this is true, that companies with fat gross operating profit margins, that is total revenue minus cost of goods sold, being very fat, meaning typically, you know, 50%-ish or more, tend to do best. There's fundamental reasons for that, but it's also historically true. And so you say to yourself, you want to put yourself in the kinds of places that work best as opposed to trying to get late in the bull market into fancy cute stories that are too tricky by half. You want to keep it simple. You want to don't swing for the fences. You want singles and doubles more than home runs. And that's another, that fat gross operating profit margin function in the second half of a bull market is another one of those elephant in the rooms that's positive. It flips off to be negative early in a bull market because early in a bull market is the thin margin companies that do best. These are all kind of simple things that are in the book that are covered at some length. And again, there's always going to be an exception as the book talks about at some length. The investing game is one of probabilities. It's not one of certainties. And you're just trying to stack the odds in your favor.
Let's talk about a chapter in your book that you said everybody hates. That's politics. But we are in the middle of a presidential election year. We will be electing a new Congress. We'll be electing a new president. What are the important things that one should glean about politics? A good example that you give is when Obamacare was passed, it was going to be curtains for the healthcare sector. And as we all know, since it passed, it turned out to be one of the best performing sectors.
Yeah. So simply going back to something that I said a few moments ago, markets hate uncertainty. And as uncertainty fades, you tend to have positiveness. So if you think about something like legislation that would affect an industry or the country as a whole, the uncertainty about what will happen as we contemplate legislation gets priced into the market. And then as the legislation finalizes, it becomes quite clear that that's been priced and the uncertainty goes away. When you get to final legislation, it is what it is. And people hate losses more than they like gains. So in a world of uncertainty, you can contemplate more downside than you can contemplate upside as the uncertainty fades away. You lose that fear of downside more relative to the potential opportunity of upside. And in politics, that's one of the reasons why both domestically and globally, gridlock has tended to be pretty good because it makes for less legislative change. The way most people think, logically, is that what I believe is good and what somebody else believes that disagrees with me is bad. And while that might be true in ways that don't relate to the stock market or to capital markets, it might be true for the culture. It might be true for the economy in the long term. In the period that markets care about, the next 3 to 30 months, the uncertainty of my great ideas against your terrible ones or your great ones against my terrible ones as they're debated leads to uncertainty, leads to fear. People hate losses more than they like gains, and it leads to negativeness. And that's true whether it's a sector or for the economy as a whole. So what comes out of that is that gridlock tends to be good in the short term for markets. When you move to the back half of president's terms, when they typically are able to engage in less leadership of the country domestically in terms of the economy, that tends to be good. The back half of president's terms is overwhelmingly positive. There's only been 2 actual negative years in the history of the S&P 500 in the third year of a president's term ever. And those were, you know, way, way, way back in 1939 and 1931. And the reality of all of this is that simply, fundamentally, with the exception of what I had said earlier, which is non-political regulatory, where things can run amiss because we don't see them and they don't get discounted into pricing. When it comes to legislative, no matter what it is, the uncertainty is the biggest dilemma. And politicians, of course, are fundamentally, you can see this year probably as much or more than ever, combative. We typically don't believe them. We think they lie a lot. We can't easily tell who does and who doesn't. We always get a winner at the end, though. You take a year like this for president, we always get a winner. We always like the one we end up with more than we thought we would at the beginning of the process. That's true even if we don't like them. And that might not be true for you individually, but for our society it is. That takes the uncertainty away and it makes it a usually favorable outcome. But as I said earlier, that can be overridden by things that are totally non-political. But the political factor and the political cycle is discussed at great length in the book. And for the most part, action on the part of the government is bad because people hate losses more than they like gain.
In your book, you have a whole chapter. In fact, it's called Throw Away This Book. But you talk about some investment classics, many of which I read, which I thought was very helpful for a lot of readers out there because there are a lot of investment books out there. But classics stand up because, I mean, you know, we still read Security Analysis. We still read The Intelligent Investor. Putting this into the book, what did you hope to accomplish with this?
Well, in my life, I've read an awful lot of investment books starting from when I was very young, and I've collected a lot of investment books. As I sit here now, I'm looking at hundreds of investment books that are here in front of my eyes, and I thought that it would be useful to readers who may not be able to calibrate getting away from some of those few that are the most famous to think about some of the maybe less famous ones that are older that you could still buy today easily online. Used to be, of course, it wasn't so easy to buy a used book. It was a harder thing to do. You couldn't just kind of go online and buy them. One of the advantages of the internet is you can find old books. So this takes people through older books, some of which are classics, but again, not so well known to people, like Where the Customer's Yacht by Schwed, which is a book from literally 75 years ago, or Steve Forbes' relatively newer book, How Capitalism Will Save Us. They break down into market books, economic books, and biographies about people that are important. For example, there's a book that I had from when I went to college called Radical's Guide to Economic Reality by Angus Black, which is a spoof book. And literally, when I read that as a kid, about 1970, it literally flipped me on my head in no time at all. And I read it in anticipation of Angus Black, which was a pen name. His real name is Roger Leroy Miller. And he was coming to my campus to talk. And I read his book in anticipation of him coming to do the talk. And literally, he flipped my head around when I read the book a couple days before his talk and then went to his talk, and took him no time at all to flip my brain around and make me think about things completely differently than I ever had. That's a useful activity for anybody.
Ken, you have a chapter in, I want to conclude here. How do you use the media? Because one of the things that we see in the media today, when any kind of event happens, whether it's a terrorist attack in Paris, whether it's a plunge in the markets on a single day, as we did the first trading day of the year, the media will dramatize and talk about it constantly, 24 hours around the clock. What do investors need to take away, and how can they use the media to their benefit?
So there's two basic points to this. The one point is, if it's widely broadcast and if it's about the next 3 months or longer than the next 30 months, you just ignore it. Hard as that may be often when some of this stuff is so tantalizing, you just ignore it. The media is mostly about things that, as it relates to markets, should not be any of your business. Then the other part is, because today we do have a much wider capability to gather information online with simple search engine optimization, et cetera, you want to look for credible sourcing of things that people aren't worrying about that are within the 3 to 30 month window. So our world today allows us access to information that we never used to have, much of which may be things that no one's talking about, no one's noticing. But the reality, as I said earlier in comment about the media in the beginning of our discussion, the media is almost solely understanding and representative of urban things. It's almost not at all understanding of non-urban things. If you cut America correctly, I believe America is about half and half. And the half of America that's non-urban, and this is largely true outside of America as well, but I think for your listeners, they can just focus on America to get the point. The media simply doesn't really understand, doesn't focus on, doesn't pay much attention, or misrepresents everything that's non-urban, and yet it's half of the country. So there's an awful lot that's out there today that you can understand and fathom. You can find information on via search that may be in the media, but nobody's talking about because the media is so myopically preoccupied with those things that gather eyeballs, which are the sensationalist things about the next 3 months right in front of our eyes or longer than 30 months out. And that's pretty much the conclusion of linking the time frame to the usage of the media.
So, Ken, if there was one point you would want your readers to walk away from after reading your book, what would that be?
Markets price all commonly known information, including what you think that's commonly known and what everybody else thinks is commonly known. And you need to make sure, as it relates to markets, that you think independently and that you think differently than the crowd. The book is not about beating the market. The book is about beating the crowd, who will do worse than the market by definition, because they will be the market less transaction cost. And they will make lots of active decisions at the wrong time. And what you need to do is remember that your job is not to beat the market. Your job is to beat the crowd. And that's not so hard to do, because the crowd is going to take off their own toes regularly. You need to make sure you don't take off your toe.
Well, Ken, I want to compliment you on a well-written book. I thoroughly enjoyed reading it. The name of the book is called Beat the Crowd, How You Can Outvest the Herd by Thinking Differently, by Ken Fisher and Elizabeth Dellinger. Ken, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. A great book, and once again, my compliments.
Thanks for having me on, Jim. It's always great to talk to you.
Thank you.
I guess I always like contrarians, Jim, because I've been one all of my life. You know, it was ever since the days in school when somebody said, you can't do that. They didn't even think you could do it or you shouldn't do it. And the first thought is, oh no, watch me. You know, that was my first thought. But here you've got a guy, Ken Fisher, who's a billionaire investor, and he's made quite a bit of money on the basis of just not following the herd and making his own decisions.
Yeah, and just to add a little color to Ken, Ken's father, Phil Fisher, wrote a book, Common Stocks, Uncommon Profits, or I get those titles messed up. But anyway, that book was very influential next to Ben Graham in Warren Buffett's career. Warren Buffett cites Ken's father, Phil Fisher, as having a major influence on his investment thinking in terms of evaluating growth stocks. And so if you look at Warren Buffett today, he's kind of a combination of those, well, actually three, you know, Ben Graham, Phil Fisher, and Charlie Munger, if you want to understand Warren Buffett. So Ken was able to use his father's principle plus his own investment acumen in terms of also evaluating the media to become a billionaire. Anyway, a great book, by the way. I highly recommend it. I really enjoyed reading Ken's book because it points to so many things that we see that go on with the media, how they're always driving us from either crisis to euphoria. And it's one of those two. But anyway, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.